Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
Hello, this is Jill Pasternak. Welcome to Crossover, the program that explores the universal language, music. Our guest today is Maestro Rosin Milanov, Associate Conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra, Artistic Director of the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Mann Center for the Performing Arts, whose 2007 season begins June 26th, Music Director of the Haddonfield Symphony in New Jersey and the New Symphony Orchestra in his native city of Sofia, Bulgaria, and the Bulgarian National Radio Symphony Orchestra. We spoke with Maestro Milanov at an event that was sponsored by the New Jersey Committee for the Philadelphia Orchestra. The committee is made up of all volunteers who work for the benefit of the educational outreach programs of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Maestro, I want to welcome you, and I want to ask you a little bit about your background and how you've achieved such success here in the both in the Delaware Valley and in New Jersey as well.
Yes. First of all, Jill, it's a great pleasure to be speaking with you today. I'm a great admirer of your work, and I listen to your station all the time when I have an opportunity. And welcome to all of you here in Jersey. I don't think we could have wished for a better afternoon weather-wise, and also I see so many smiles on your faces. The food is great, the wine is fantastic, and I'm really looking forward to getting to know you better, not only, of course, as audience to our concerts, but also as people to people here in events like this. I'm delighted to be able to make music here in the Delaware Valley, and really it was sort of a strike of very good luck when 6 years ago I applied to two positions at the same time. That was the music director position of the Haddonfield Symphony and the assistant conducting position of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Those two auditions were within 1 week of each other, and at that time the president of the orchestra was Joe Kluger, and he knew that I was auditioning for the Haddonfield Symphony position, and when they interviewed me for the orchestra, they said, does the Haddonfield Symphony know that you're also applying here? I said, well, they better know. But I went to school here in Philadelphia back in the early 90s. I am a graduate of the Curtis Institute of Music. I studied conducting there with Otto Werner Mueller, and then we also share a school with Jill. We both went to Juilliard School afterwards. And
well, I went before. I was a
just a few years before.
But in those years, one didn't really apply to the orchestra because that wasn't a very good job. And that, of course, has changed. Changed a great deal now, and certainly the Philadelphia Orchestra is one of the premier, always was actually one of the premier orchestras in the world, and still is. And the Haddonfield Symphony, I do remember when I came down to Philadelphia 19 years ago, the Haddonfield Symphony was just a kind of a nice little symphony. As a matter of fact, I think I played a couple of concerts with them because I was,
really?
You know, new in the area. And then suddenly it began to develop, and I think you have many, many Curtis students that,
yes,
that have gone there.
Yes, we have many Curtis and Julia. Students nowadays.
So, yes, so it of course has become really a symphony to be reckoned with, and has established a reputation so near Philadelphia, where you have this great world-class orchestra, and a very, very fine conductor as well. So it's really a place where music is being made, and I think the connection, the river, the bridge carries the music back and forth in New Jersey, and certainly in South Jersey here, the participation of all of you people that support both of the symphonies is really quite incredible. And for Maestro Milanov. It's a very easy commute, I guess. You don't have to fly very far.
It is a dream commute, particularly this year that we actually chose to locate our entire season only in one place, which is in Camden, in the Rutgers University Gordon Theater. So now it's just a short hop across the Ben Franklin Bridge. And I don't view the New Jersey and the Pennsylvania as two states, because we live in one metropolitan area. It happens to be comprised with some of the most exciting areas here, the South Jersey area and, of course, the Philadelphia area. And we're connected not only with the bridge, but we have cultural attractions that make us compete with some of the greatest cities in the world. And when you think about some of the cities in Europe that are divided by a river, you don't necessarily find this, in a way, artificial division, because, you know, one part belongs to one state, the other part belongs to the other state, because really a city is where you could take not only a place where you could call your own home, but where you could spend your quality free time in a place where it gives you enough satisfaction on both levels, material and also spiritual.
Absolutely. I think also it's become a destination because the world has changed, and certainly this area has changed very, very much. I remember being from North Jersey originally. We thought that South Jersey was New Brunswick. I mean, we didn't know that anything. We didn't know anything that was below that. But Maestro, tell us a little bit. I mean, it's a very serious situation now with orchestras and keeping them going. What is the answer? I mean, we have a real situation, a real problem throughout the world as well, I believe, for support of the orchestras and funding for the orchestras and many things. What is your opinion?
My opinion is we are not really looking here into orchestras in particular. We are looking into things that we could get life nowadays, because our society is turning into society which is so used to consuming things that are pre-made, things that are just created there for our own convenience. For instance, if we want to go to a supermarket and have a very quick meal because we have no time to cook at home, of course you go to the frozen food section, you pick something that you reheat at home. If I have to give an analogy in the music business, you know, instead of going and attending a live performance, you go to a music store, or now you don't even go to a music store because it's closed. The biggest one in Philadelphia just closed
Tower
this
Records,
week, Tower
yeah.
Records. You go online, you order a CD, or you have something at home that you put it in your stereo and you play it. But this is not really the real thing. Just like the frozen Italian meal doesn't taste Italian, the same way a pre-recorded sound on a CD does not sound like a live performance in the orchestra. So to me, it's really a question of appreciating the good quality that we tend to expect from other things that we normally demand from life. And I think it should apply to the same extent to classical music and also to other forms of arts. And we are used to going and seeing a movie because it was something which was created by a director, by an enormous amount of people that work as a production team, by an enormous amount of money that's invested in that. But this is just something that never changes. No matter how many times you're going to see the movie, it's going to be exactly the same. While if you go to a concert hall, I can guarantee you that you're never going to hear the same performance twice. It's something which is absolutely unique. It's like a painting by Picasso or a painting by Monet, which could not be duplicated twice. You either own the original or you don't own it at all. You own some other painting. And this is what musicians do nowadays in the concert halls. We try to really position ourselves as people that provide something quite unique that you could not get twice. And if people have the interest in that, they could come and they could become part of what we do. And I can guarantee you that in both orchestras, the Philadelphia Orchestra and the Haddonfield Symphony, it's the greatest joy and, in a way, goal of our lives to share the music with your life. Because it's very different when you perform in an empty hall. It's very different when you feel that your art is not needed. Because all these people, they have sacrificed their entire life in order to become musicians, or some people think of us, of course, as entertainers, in the high respect of the word entertainment. And normally you could not become at the top of your level until, unless you start at a very early age. And all musicians that I know, and I'm sure, Jill, this applies to you as well, we have started at age 5, 6, and this was pretty much a dedication of our entire life. And I really hope that, and I'm absolutely sure that I will manage to retire as a classical musician and will still be able to perform concerts for a live audience instead of, you know, there is such a danger in today's world that we will become so alienated and attend less and less public forums, not only in music, but also in all the other aspects of our life.
Well, I think that's it. And one of the reasons for this is, first of all, the people have other forms of entertainment, and they say, well, you know, I'm going to watch some TV, or I won't, it's raining out, I don't want to go. But I think this whole business of educating your children as well to the wonders of music and the beauties of orchestral music and going to live concerts and attending, this is probably the secret. I think, without sounding like someone that is reminiscing, years ago, we were brought up to appreciate music. It was in the schools. It was something that was going on. You were exposed to it, whether you liked it or not. And a lot of people who are not musical remember music in the schools. Well, we don't have that now the way it was. If anything has to go, as far as the budget goes, it's in the schools. And one of the purposes, of course, of this wonderful gathering is that there is the education committee here that is part of the Philadelphia Orchestra that is really doing spectacular things with their program. And Maestro, you can talk a little bit about that. I know that you, when you go and give the children's concerts, you're very vocal when you speak to them. What kind of reactions do you get?
The education programs are absolutely essential nowadays for exactly the reasons that you mentioned, because if we don't do them, we risk not only not having the children being exposed to one of the greatest achievements of human civilization, which is classical music and music itself, but we also, of course, on a more material perspective of what we do, we are not going to have any audience tomorrow. And in order for me to retire as a classical musician,
soon,
we need to have people in the hall. We need people that not only come there because they have to, but we want them to come and really appreciate it. We want the music to change their life. We want the music to help them to get through their daily problems. We want the music to inspire them. We want the music to become something without which they could not live with. And what we do for the children, of course, children always copy what their parents or grandparents or other adults around them enjoy. And I happen to have a niece that's 4 years old, and she's already going to concerts. She goes to full-length concerts, not children's concerts. And 2 weeks ago, I was conducting in Bulgaria. She came and heard the entire Shostakovich Symphony No. 11, which runs for 65 minutes, and it's not a child's piece.
Hardly.
And but they watch their parents, they watch their uncles and aunts, they watch the other adults in their family. They see that they enjoy that. They see that they get moved by it. And children copy the emotions. They don't only copy your actions, but they try to copy your emotions. And I think if we could give them an example of how music moves us, how music makes us better, how music makes us feel like one big community, I think we have achieved a lot. And I think what we try to do in the Philadelphia Orchestra Children's Concerts is achieve exactly that. We don't only rely on the music itself. We always try to give different handles to many other things that they could possibly know or are about to learn in the school, even if they don't become classical musicians. And I'll give an example. We performed the entire Shostakovich's Ninth Symphony, which is a very important piece in his life, written at the end of World War II. And we decided that instead of just playing the piece by itself, we are going to compose a little play attached to it, based on letters that were written within the three members of one family during the World War II. We had the father, who was a composer and who got sent to the front in Stalingrad to fight. We had the mother, who was a party official and stayed back in Moscow. And we had the daughter that was growing up at that time. And somehow tying up the piece of music with the atmosphere of the time when it was written, and also portraying the exchange of letters between these three people, brought so many parallels between what was happening back then and what's going on perhaps right now for some of the families, and also brought up some interesting things for the students to get interested about what was going on in the Second World War, what was going on in the Russia, how are the Russians different than the Americans back there. And it gives you a lot of opportunities to explore the context of the musical piece. So it's not just a piece of music, it suddenly becomes part of our lives, part of our history, part of everything that we are. So we go back in the past, we put it in the right context, and we bring it with a very strong emotional content so people could relate to
it. And of course, Shostakovich himself, if you read any of the material that is written about Shostakovich and what inspired him to write his symphonies, it's fascinating because they are really program music. I mean, he has talked about, he has depicted scenes in his symphonies, certainly, and one doesn't even realize that when one is not exposed. This is the 100th year of the anniversary
yes,
of his birth.
It's a big Shostakovich.
So there's an enormous amount of Shostakovich being played. Shostakovich had a terrible time. Stalin ruined his career at some point there. He just absolutely didn't allow his music to be played. And he fought. He fought musically, Shostakovich. And so, I mean, here's a case where what you're saying is absolutely true, because you're painting the picture. And so did Shostakovich when he wrote his music. And I think the more we delve into the background of music, the more we're educated into the reasons that certain works have been created, the more we appreciate them, we listen to them differently. But once again, you are people that are interested, and I guess that's really the crux of it all, that we have to be interested, and we have to pass this on to those who don't really know that much about what it is to support a symphony orchestra, to support an education program, to keep it going, because if it's lost, there is no life without art. There's no life without music. This is the civilized part of life. This is what really makes us go, as Maestro says. Now, you are a conductor of an orchestra in Sofia, and it is, you said, the first privately funded orchestra. We live in a country where it's always privately funded. What is it like when you have funding, federal funding for the arts? How does that impact on what you do?
Well, I could give you a couple of examples. Right now, at the moment, I have two orchestras in Sofia. One of them is very similar to Haddonfield Symphony. It's an orchestra which has a very strong educational mission of training younger professionals in order to help them to get jobs as professional musicians in a bigger orchestras. That's the new symphony orchestra, that's the private orchestra. And on the other hand, in the same city, I'm the chief conductor of the Bulgarian National Radio, which is entirely funded by the parliament. And it's the biggest orchestra in Bulgaria. So going there in Sofia, of course, I have to work with them both at the same time. And I could tell you that there are so many advantages to the one which is privately funded. First of all, because you have no bureaucracy of any type. You have several people in the office. You have an executive director. You have a person that deals with the fundraising. You have a person that deals, of course, with the production elements of. And if we decide to do something, we could do it literally 2 weeks later. We don't have to ask for special permission. Our audience feels a much bigger ownership of the product that we present, because they come to the concert, and because they support the orchestra, they support it by choice, they feel that partially what's presented on stage, they are also part of it in a very positive way. Why, on the other hand, when you have a state-supported orchestra, there is no incentive. We have about 25 people, administrators, that are above us. And if you want to even achieve the smallest thing, you have to fill out maybe 3 or 4 paper forms. Then you have to bring them to a secretary. The secretary has to bring them to another secretary. The secretary, it's a crazy story that I don't want to describe in a detail, but a decision could be made the minimum amount of time for a decision is probably between a month and a half, and sometimes I have waited for 6 months for a very, very simple problem. This is one hand. On the other hand, whatever we make in terms of ticket sales from the radio season, it doesn't go into the orchestra account. It goes into the big account of the entire national radio, which has 1,500 employees. So whether we sell our house or whether we don't sell it makes absolutely no financial difference or incentive to anyone that is directly connected to the orchestra.
So what is the incentive? The incentive, the incentive
is that you really need to love what you're doing. And if you, fortunately I have enough people in the radio that do it because of the love for music. And they have to deal on a daily basis with this administrative machine. That is obviously very difficult to deal with, but I only dream of the moment when, you know, this energy that devote to the bureaucracy, to the bureaucratic part of the organization, could be channeled into something more creative. Then it will be really amazing.
Do they have any control over repertoire?
The administration, of course, doesn't have a control over the repertoire. But the way the audience is developed, they have no fundraising, they have no sponsors, because the entire bill is paid by the parliament directly. Imagine if the Congress pays every single cent that it costs us to run the Philadelphia Orchestra. And it doesn't allow you even to sell your own tickets. We have to find a company that sells the tickets for us, because as a government organization, you're not allowed to make profit or something or exchange of some sort. So it's really a very interesting situation that...
But you have orchestras. The thing is, you have orchestras because the government is taking care of things.
Yes.
So
mm-hmm.
we're kind of caught in a catch-22
That's
here.
That's the other extreme.
Yes, of course.
Those are the two extremes.
Yes.
And ideally, I think it should be somewhere right in the middle, where the government should take a certain responsibility, particularly when there is excellence. Demonstrated when there is a history of making a big difference for you as an orchestra and as an arts institution. And right now, unfortunately, that's how it works in the States, is that you have to have a special senator, you have to have a special congressman that will adopt you as a pet project. And if they manage to do that, you might get really lucky and get a line item somewhere in your state budget or something else. And I don't think it's based necessarily on the way it should be, because it should be purely based on the merit and how much of a difference you make in people's lives. And these are things that you cannot really measure with ticket sales sometimes. These are things that you measure with how you feel after the symphony is over at a particular night, how when you see the spark in the eyes of everybody leaving Verizon Hall or the hall, and when you see that, well, there are certain things that we could not measure, like the way you could not, it's very similar to, I always say, to a religious experience. How would you measure the satisfaction that you get after you leave a church, after a religious experience? You cannot measure that. And it's the same with art. It's the same with music.
Well, I want to throw a little something at you. What about repertoire, again? I mean, you're talking about, you're educating the public as well. As a conductor of an orchestra, you say, this is repertoire that you should hear. This is what's happening in music. This is what's going on. You should listen to this. You should take your medicine. Now, a lot of people feel that way. What's kind of interesting is the more you're exposed, I think the less shocking it is to you to hear certain repertoire, because that's
Absolutely.
What's going on.
Yeah.
And it's not that you have to know what's going on particularly, I think, because the more you know, of course, the more you appreciate. But on an emotional level, what kind of reaction are you getting to bringing in contemporary music into the program? And this seems to be a situation. I like to use that word. It's kind of a non-committal word. Something's going on as far as programming is concerned. How do you arrive at repertoire? What kind of feedback do you get from the audience, if at all?
Well, I will bring another analogy again. Obviously, today I will be using a lot of those. Recently, they did a big remodeling of the Museum of Modern Art in New York. I'm sure you're all aware of it. It was everybody loved the old Museum of Art in New York. They thought that it was, a very special place where it almost felt classical, because we were very familiar with all the new works that were in there. Now they reshuffled everything. Of course, they have a lot more space to display new works. They have space where they will have a dedicated rooms to emerging artists that we have never heard of. And all these things, they, of course, you go to the museum, you walk through all the galleries, through all the halls, the rooms, and you realize, actually, this is all art. It's not that different. Like, I see something from the 1950s, and then I see something which was made yesterday, literally. And I see so many common elements. And I think we go to the museum and we have absolutely no problem seeing a Picasso next to a Dutch master from the 15th or 16th century. We have no problem going from that style to the next style. And in classical music, sometimes we do, because we feel that, of course, the level of understanding of a modern piece sometimes requires a different type of processor in our computer. And in classical music, things are developing in a very rapid fashion. And I feel that just like in art, just like in computers, things are changing very quickly. And there is no way to know what music which was created today is going to be a masterpiece today, tomorrow. There was no way to say that during Beethoven's time. There was no way to say that during Brahms' time. There was no way to say that during Stravinsky's time. We know of so many pieces of great music that we appreciate nowadays that have been a flop the first time they were heard. The most famous one, of course, being The Rite of Spring, Stravinsky.
Which you still get a reaction to, by the way, if you play that.
But unless we give a chance to that work, you know, we are sort of going to stop the art from developing where it needs to go.
Are you doing a lot of contemporary music? I know that you have done quite a bit.
Yeah, I do, of course. We all do. I mean, I have premiered a lot of new pieces. I have given the first performance of a lot of works, and I'm still interested, and I'm still looking for those great masterpieces that would compare with the symphonies of Shostakovich, for instance, or with the music of Britten, or with the pieces of Jennifer Higdon, for instance.
Now,
a constant look for perfect music.
But it has turned. I think that
yes.
The new music is more accessible than the music of perhaps 20 years ago. I think that something has happened to the new music, like Jennifer Higdon, like Aaron J. Kernis. This is music that is really kind of appealing. It is. I mean, I don't say that to kind of, you know, sweeten it, but it is. It's something that is, there's a turnaround, isn't
it? Because composers know that they have only one chance to communicate their ideas with you. And if you don't grasp it, if you don't like it during that first performance, chances of a repeat performance are very slim. And I think people in the past, perhaps partially because of what we mentioned in relation to the Bulgarian National Orchestra, when a composer knows that his piece was going to be performed by an orchestra no matter what, and then you sit down and write something which is not necessarily communicative. Like, you write it mostly for yourself, but you're not concerned whether your language is going to be comprehended by the other very important third element in our equation, which is the audience. You know, the composer being one, the performers being the second, and the audience being the third crucial one. So sometimes when the composers ignore the third element, the audience, I think you could end up with something which is not, it could be groundbreaking on paper, but, you know, it's just like a recipe that might look absolutely amazing on paper, but when you cook it, then you don't want to taste it.
The way he said that, I don't know. So what are we looking forward, what menu are we looking forward to for the season?
Well, what we try to do, and that this is really the truth for both the Philadelphia Orchestra and the Haddonfield Symphony, if I could sort of analyze the direction in which our repertoire politics is developing, is that we are trying to create a special event out of each performance, out of each program that we present to you. There is a lot of thought that goes into each one of them. And, of course, in Haddonfield Symphony, having to deal with only 6 programs a year is nowhere near to having to deal with close to 44 different programs a year, I think, with the Philadelphia Orchestra, not counting the summer when we have 3 programs per week. And you could imagine that on one hand, that this is an enormous, vast amount of repertoire that we have to cover. The concerts are not only for us as audience. The concerts are a very important part of how you develop an orchestra. Because you can't have an orchestra play the same piece or the same style throughout the entire year. You have to make sure that what they do also gives them enough artistic incentive to develop in the right way. Because every moment when they open their cases of the musical instruments, and when the conductor walks on stage or we start making music together, it's a process that always goes in only one direction. Just the time goes only in one direction. We always try to perfect ourselves, because there is one thing which is true for all human beings, is that we learn for as long as we are alive. And you just simply cannot go back. So I think it's very important that you take this into consideration. What is good for the orchestra on this stage for them to play? What is good for me as a conductor? Where are my strengths? What should I be conducting and what should I not be conducting at this stage? Because, you know, we as an artist also have certain developments.
Of course, yeah.
We communicate, of course, using the medium of music, but there is something more that unites us on stage. It's not just a very elementary love for music. It's the desire to create this perfect illusion, which each musical work has. Illusion of one dream world where each one of the musicians is contributing to part of it, and to which the conductor gives the big frame in which that entire world could basically be built. And you feel that with orchestras, and with other orchestras you don't feel it. So it's a lot of also question of chemistry, and whether you're compatible or not.
Well, I think Maestro Milanov has built a beautiful world for us here, both in New Jersey and in Pennsylvania. And a pleasure to speak with you and
Thank you, Jill.
Listen to you all the time
Thank you.
To share your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.